And as is fairly obvious, this is obviously a taster of my book coming out from Fordham University Press, due out this month, although I don't have a book in hand yet. Hopefully soon you have the flyers there with your handout today. I hope everyone has a handout today. There are more down here. That's missing. In 1984, in what was to become a foundational text for attempts to understand our current era of globalisation, Frederick Jameson cited the then little-known San Francisco language writer Bob Perlman and his poem China, alongside canonical examples from Samuel Beckett to Andy Warhol. For Jameson, Perlman's short, disjunctive poem was exemplary of the cultural logic of late capitalism. That's the title of the essay. This poem was exemplary of the cultural logic of late capitalism precisely because it had, in Jameson's words, little enough to do with that referent called China. As a unified collective subject of history, according to Jameson, China was antithetical both to the breakdown of the subject in postmodern culture and to the fragmentation of late capitalism as a whole. Some 2.5 decades later, much has changed. Today, it would be hard to imagine discussion of multinational capitalism, to use Jameson's other more neutral term, that dismissed the relevance of China. Literary and cultural studies have likewise taken a transnational and increasingly Asian turn. This turn throws into relief the narrowness of Jameson's assumed Western frame of reference, especially when compared to the poem's planetary perspective. Perlman's poem begins, "We live on the third world from the sun," number 3. We can now see that Jameson was writing at the beginning of a period of global change. This shift included the transformation of China after the end of the Cultural Revolution, the emergence between the two superpowers of number 3, as Jameson described China in 1984. It also included Gorbachev's accession to power in 1995, the Chinese government crackdown on June 4, 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall and communist regimes in Eastern and Central Europe the same year, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War in 1991, and the explosive capitalist expansion ushered in by Deng Xiaoping's 1992 boost to free market reforms. During the period of historical flux, when the old Cold War binaries unravelled, but the new local global dichotomies were yet to coalesce into conceptual commonplaces, avant-garde writers sought to reimagine the world. They did so by intertwining linguistic strangeness and cross-cultural engagements in ways that offer new possibilities for reconceiving literary and cultural studies. Recognising these possibilities requires extending literary and cultural studies beyond even two languages or regions of the globe and outside familiar contours of transnational affiliation and influence. It means exploring how reference such as China function not merely as arbitrary signifiers of a global reality, nor just as markers of cultural difference, but as multi-layered figures in cross-cultural encounters and readings, such as Perlman's use of a Chinese language primer as the impetus for his poem, China, or Jameson's 1985 trip to China, which shaped his attempts to theorise our era of globalisation. These cross-cultural readings are, of course, always particularly located and frequently globally oriented. They attempt to imagine the world or the globe as a whole, yet they are also embedded in a messy, complex reality of interactions that a dichotomy such as local or global elides. Combining linguistic strangeness with appeals to foreignness and transnational affiliation, writers responded to this period of change by drawing on the concept of estrangement as it had developed in 20th century literary theory and practice. Through estrangement, writers such as Beidou from China, Dmitry Klegov from Russia, and Charles Bernstein from the United States negotiated a period of historical flux and the binary of sameness and difference that undergirds Cold War and transcultural poetics, comparative literature, world literature, and global theory. In so doing, they also destabilise this binary in multiple ways. Baedahl became central to contemporary Anglophone debates over world literature in 1990, when Stephen Owen used a review of Baedahl's collection, The August Sleepwalker, to describe the emergent phenomenon of a world poetry in which nothing is lost in translation. Appearing just a year after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the massacre of June 4, 1989, which forced Baedahl into exile, Owen's review and the response it provoked are entwined with a critical moment in recent Chinese and world history. The debate surrounding Baedahl's work illustrates how the end of the Cold War and the rise of globalisation led scholars to address literature on a planetary scale. More than just recognising the limitations of a national paradigm, this transnational turn took literary texts as allegories of our global condition in ways that Baedahl's poetry itself draws into question. Owen's review of the US edition of The August Sleepwalker reflects the dramatic events of the previous year, of 1989, in both China and Eastern Europe. Owen picks up on the translator of The August Sleepwalker, Bonnie McDougall's insistence that Baedahl's poetry is translatable. By translating her claim for translatability into the new historical situation. In the Cold War context, McDougall emphasised the translatability and universal images of Baedahl's poetry. By appealing to the notion of world literature based on universal literary values, she sought greater scholarly recognition for contemporary Chinese poetry in the West, and so to gain some political protection for Baedahl. In the post-Cold War world, Owen connects translatability to globalisation and the end of history, echoing Fukuyama a year earlier. In this new era of globalisation, Owen reads Baedahl's work not as national but as global allegory, marking the shift to a post-national condition that he wishes to suggest. Owen cites the final stanza of Baedahl's poem Hello, Baihua Mountain as an example of how, in Owen's words, when Baedahl's poetry succeeds, and sometimes it succeeds wonderfully, it does so not by words, which are always trapped within the nationality of language and its borders, but by envisagements of images possible only with words. Carefully chosen by Baedahl to open his major Chinese and English language collections of the 1980s, this early poem in fact positions itself much more ambiguously in relation to the various national and international allegories through which his work has been read. It provides a greeting not only to the reader first encountering his work and opening the collection, but also to the world in relation to which Owen seeks to position him. The poem's structure of call and response anticipates and questions the collective identities and allegorical frames through which its assertion of individual voice might be read. And I'll read you the poem here, which is on the first page of the book. The sound of a guitar drifts through the air. Cupped in my hand, a snowflake quivers lightly. Thick patches of fog draw back to reveal a mountain range rolling like a melody. I have gathered the inheritance of the four seasons. There is no sign of man in the valley. Picked wild flowers continue to grow. Their flowering is their time of death. Along the path in the primordial wood, green sunlight flows through the slits. A russet hawk interprets into bird cries the mountain's tale of terror. Abruptly, I cry out, "Hello, Baihua Mountain." "Hello, my child," comes the echo from a distant waterfall. It was a wind within a wind, drawing a restless response from the land. I whispered, and the snowflake drifted from my hand down the abyss. For Owen, Hello Baihua Mountain is not only an example of a poem in which nothing is lost in translation. It is an allegory for the entire homogenising process of globalisation. The image of a snowflake in the hand caught and carried by the wind, this is in Owen's words, this image of a snowflake in the hand caught and carried by the wind of a poet's whisper and blown into an abyss where there are no margins and no frontiers is for Owen a frightening vision of the truly international poem. The snowflake drifting into the abyss is at once a perfectly translatable international poetic image and an allegory of the dislocated international poem, which is, in Owen's words, an intricate shape on a blank background without frontiers, a shape that undergoes metamorphoses. Unlike national poetry, which has a history in a landscape, this international poetry, Owen writes, does not have a history, nor is it capable of leaving a trace that might constitute a history. Presumably, like the snowflake, it remains in one's hand momentarily, only to vanish into the abyss without a trace. Inverting Owen's interpretation, however, one could read the poem as allegorising literature deeply rooted, even trapped, within a place, history, tradition, and language. Though written much earlier, by inviting multiple allegorical readings, it anticipates and complicates not only the negotiation between official and unofficial nationalist and internationalist perspectives in China in the 1980s, but also the local global binary of post-Cold War world literature through which Owen reads Baidel's work. Snowflakes often do leave a faint trace of moisture, a sign of life. Likewise, inasmuch as the poem implicitly compares itself to a snowflake, its momentary capture frames the poem, right, beginning and the end, with the arrival and departure of the snowflake. As much as snowflake frames the poem, it also points to the contrast between the two. When composed by Baidel in the early 1970s, the poem was under constant threat of confiscation and destruction, and in this sense was snowflake-like. Yet even then, the poem's permanence as a literary artefact, its reproducibility through memorisation or hand copying, would have stood in marked contrast to the fleeting, singular, unrepeatable moment that it recounts. Later, this contrast is heightened by the poem's appearance in a collection that by 1988 had run to 35,000 copies in its second Chinese edition. Moreover, in the poem itself, although the snowflake is lost, the abyss does not swallow everything, but reciprocates with a verbal response to the lyric subject's greeting. The landscape of a specifically designated mountain, a site near Beijing, is an essential voice in the poem. The mountain's echo not only confirms a living connection between lyric subject, poem, and specific landscape, but also emphasises historicity through intergenerational exchange. My child, at the end. Equally, the poem depends crucially on the linguistic materiality of the Chinese word for snowflake. The very word through which Owen discerns an example, an allegory of the dislocated international poem, of a perfectly translatable poetry that does not rely on words, but purely on images. In fact, the Chinese word used here, xuehua, literally snow flower, makes for a completely different image to that connoted by the English snowflake, and contributes to the full resonances of the reference to wildflowers, yehua, in the second stanza. The two words, wildflowers and snowflake, are further connected by the rhyme of xue and ye. Far from connoting a brittle, detached, undefined piece of the world, the snow flower suggests a thing of beauty that is, significantly, rooted in the earth, in the landscape, and so connected with a particular land and nation. The flower's impermanence, their flowering is their time of death, in the poem's words, is part of a cycle that will also bring renewal, a sense of reciprocity affirmed by the echo. The flower in Snowflake also links it with the name of the mountain. Bai Hua uses the same flower character, Hua, and means 100 flowers. While names in Chinese as in English become conventionalized so that one is not immediately conscious of their original meanings, the individualized characters of the name of the mountain are clearly emphasized in the echo in the penultimate stanza, Bai Hua, or 100 flowers. The connection between the name of the mountain and the snowflake further reinforces the rooting of the word for snowflake in a particular Chinese landscape, a connection between land and poetic image that takes place in and through the Chinese language. If, as Owen argues, the snowflake in part stands for the poem, then the poem is also a flower. The image of poetry and of art generally is flowers that bloom, coupled with the 100 flowers of the title, cannot help but recall Mao Zedong's famous directive, let 100 flowers bloom, let 100 schools contend. This directive gave the 1956 to 1957 100 Flowers campaign its name. Later, in 1978, Baydar would connect the brief moment of cultural liberalisation connected with the democracy war to this earlier thought by insisting with Karl Marx that there are no black flowers, and hence emphasising the need for multiplicity. Here, however, the allusion to cultural liberalisation contrasts with the Cultural Revolution era of the early 1970s, when the poem was written and when the poet had no hope of publishing his work and only dared share it with a group of close friends. As in this poem, in the 1950s, the flowers died even as they bloomed, cut down by the anti-rightist campaign that followed. The poem that survives in the inclement weather of the early 1970s must be hardy. It is a snowflower, frozen, waiting for another moment of thaw, so that an audience of readers, and not just the empty valley, will hear and respond to its voice. Read from the historical perspective of the poet at the time of composition, the lost snowflake falling into the abyss becomes a symbol of the Cultural Revolution, and so the impossibility of a world poetry. Read in the Chinese, the word xiehua, snowflake, is marked by its historical and linguistic specificities. Translated by Owen into a symbol of world poetry, the snowflake is essentially translatable. It is a universal figure that both exemplifies and stands for detachment from historical events that, in the other reading, might have seemed to trap the poem, freeze its flower, and cut it off from the possibility of translation and an international audience. The dislocation, isolation, and erasure of history that Owen identifies emerges out of the historical and political context of early 1970s China. It is expressed in the untranslatable linguistic materiality of Baydar's Chinese words. Yet the two interpretations are not as exclusive as they may seem. Each appeals to a historical moment, the Cultural Revolution or the end of the Cold War, that is imagined as marking the end of history and the erasure of tradition. Together, these interpretations produce a third allegory of poetry. In this allegory, poetry is frozen within a particular place and time, but is also, like allegory itself, which Walter Benjamin envisages as profoundly alienated, the opposite of all poetry of the soil, the poem is simultaneously able to bloom forth anywhere, to float on the wind, knowing no nationality. Reflecting the competing pressures of his poetry's position as national allegory and world literature in the 1980s, Baydar chose to open his major English and Chinese collections with this poem, a poem that both invites and unsettles each allegorical reading, the national and the international or global. Baydar's act of finding his voice is staged through an echo, suggesting a poetics focused on translation between languages, voices, and interpretations, including allegories of national and world literature. The poem greets by Hua Mountain, the reader and the world at large. Thus it addresses and enacts the moment of encounter between the emptying out of historical and linguistic specificity and the particularity of the text's Chinese linguistic materiality and of its historical and political location. In so doing, the poem calls into question the opposition itself, the rhetorical structure of originary voice and echo upon which it is predicated. The late 1980s and early 1990s witnessed the rise of an international market for contemporary Chinese and Russian artworks. If you turn to page 2, you can see a couple of indicative examples. Zheng Hongtu's portrait of Mao Zedong on a Quaker oats container, or Alexander Kosolapov's combination of an image of Lenin and a Coca-Cola advertisement. Such works in the Western pop and conceptual art practices on which they draw illustrate the subordination of local and national traditions to the global economic and artistic system. Marking the enthusiastic entry of their countries into global capitalism, they cash in on the appeal of dated communist iconography to a Western audience. They capture the mood of Owen's view that Baydar's work foretold a world literature or world culture without history or nationality. Yet the case of writer and artist Dmitry Plegov tells a different story about the fate of national literary and artistic traditions in the transition to our era of globalization, a story that involves a complex interplay between his native Russia and the West, and between his local milieu and the international world of contemporary art. His work has largely been read in the context of Russian literary and artistic culture, everyday Soviet and post-Soviet life, and Soviet ideology and post-Soviet Russian nationalism. Yet from the beginning, Plegov's address to this national context was intimately related to an appeal to a wider world. His exploration of Samizdat publishing as an artistic practice, for example, connects the Russian intelligentsia's fetishization of the universal value contained in these fragile, laboriously produced texts, and connects this fetishization to the pervasiveness of repetition and copying in international conceptualist and post-conceptualist art. Rather than simply contrasting local culture with a global language of contemporary art, Plegov brings together various local and transnational languages and cultures, a process he repeatedly describes as пересечение, or intersection. He undermines each discourse's claim to totality by staging its encounter with another such system, extending Mikhail Bakhtin's view that the command and manipulation of genres is a form of agency. Plegov emphasizes both the unfreedom of endless repetition and the freedom of each gesture among the infinite possibilities of intersecting systems and languages. He insists that, in his own words, no single language can encompass a person entirely. In the 1970s, Plegov began questioning the mythologies of the Russian literary tradition in a number of ways, including through his frequently hilarious poems written in the voice of a Soviet policeman. And I've given you an example on page 2 of the handout, which I'm not going to read in the interest of time. And in another way in which he questioned these mythologies of Russian literary tradition was through his verbatim reproduction of Russian literary classics. In his 1978 elongated collection, for example, he included the wholesale reproduction of the opening lines of Pushkin's Eugene Onegin, and what would become a signature procedure recurring across hundreds, if not thousands, of his works in various media for the rest of his life. Plegov produced around 30,000 poems, I think. Plegov's appropriative approach coincided with the publication of the influential essay The Existentialist Preconditions of Conceptualist Art in 1977 by Boris Groys in the Samizdat Journal 37, or 37. Groys's essay introduced Western conceptualist art by way of Borges's Pierre Menard, who sought to reproduce Don Quixote word for word, line for line. Apparently, unwittingly, Groys described Plegov's approach. Groys hadn't yet become aware of Plegov's practice. And Groys also anticipated his later, more radical verbatim reproductions. Groys's follow-up essay, Moscow Romantic Conceptualism, led to the application of the term conceptualist to the artists and writers of Plegov's milieu. In this essay, while noting that conceptual practice originated in the West, Groys identifies distinctive elements in Russian conceptualism, such as the continued unity of the Russian soul and mystical experience. The essay does not, however, refer to Plegov, whose conceptual policemen and reproductions of Eugene Onegin interrogate the very clichés of Russianness that shape the Russian cultural mythology of the poet and artist, and to which Groys is appealing here, you know, the idea of the Russian soul and so forth. So for both Groys and Plegov, what after this essay comes to be known as Moscow conceptualism depended on Soviet and Russian cultural mythologies and texts seen in relation to the West. But Plegov refused to be limited by the cultural assumptions about Russia and the West in Groys's analysis. Plegov's 1982 painting Sky and Sea, or Nebo e More, which is on page 3 of the handout, seems almost a direct response to Groys's attempt to encompass Moscow conceptualism within a single theory and define its difference from the West. Sky and Sea unites a specifically Russian context with an appeal to a wider, expressly Western world through its combination of Russian and English. Just as Plegov's policeman occupies the centre of a world defined by both the East-West Cold War axis and the limits of the natural world, as the line in the poem goes, and from the sea can be seen the policeman, and from the sky, and from the east and from the west. So too, similarly, in Sky and Sea, the world of the visual work is defined by the natural limits of its title and repeated words, Sky and Sea. and these are inflected by the east-west axis of the juxtaposed English and Russian in their contrasting Roman and Cyrillic scripts. Unlike the English sky and sea here, the large Russian Morya, which takes up the whole image, there's the letters in the background there, which I hope you can see. The large Russian Morya in the central Dnieper, and especially the single red Duh up here, or spirit, transcend the clearly demarcated sections of the image and its binary divisions between east and west, sky and sea, black and white, Russian and English. By producing intersections between these supposed opposites, Pregev's image cites and calls into question Russia's supposed superior spiritual values, the very cliched notions to which Groys had appealed 3 years earlier in contrasting Western and Russian conceptualisms. Where Groys wanted to police the boundaries between Russian and Western conceptualism, Pregev appropriated that other trope of national consciousness, the dynamic figure of the mediator who stands between East and West at the crossroads of many languages, cultures, and traditions. In 1989, Pregev attended the conference Language Consciousness Society. This conference took place in Leningrad and also involved a number of writers from the United States. One of these writers, Michael Davidson, describes receiving a small packet stapled on all sides, containing, Pregev says, fragments of his poems torn into tiny confetti. For Davidson, this packet was a metaphor for both the torn-up city filled with trenches and potholes and the change of weather, the shift in political climate that enabled writers previously divided by the Iron Curtain to meet. Writing alongside Davidson in the book Leningrad, American Writers in the Soviet Union, another US poet, Lynn Hajinian, interpreted Pregev's gift in two contexts, Soviet censorship and social animosity to poetry. Hajinian's interpretation suggests that the work appealed to a particular image of dissident Soviet literature abroad, censorship, and yet could also be read in a proto-post-Soviet context, with the kind of increasing indifference to poetry associated with kind of Western market capitalism. While satirising and celebrating Soviet summer's dark culture, Pregev's little coffins of rejected verse, of which this is an example here on your handout, gained new currency in the late Soviet moment. They came to stand for the burial of Soviet summer's dark culture as a result of the liberalisation of publishing. They also represented Pregev's own rebuilding, or perestroika, and rearticulation of that culture through works that appealed to the exchange value, not of words on the page, but of contemporary art operating within a globalised marketplace. As Davidson Riley noted, the business card Pregev gave him was written in Roman characters, as though for Western export. Seen in this light, the little coffins are the ultimate globally marketable local product for a poet whose work would otherwise be limited to a Russian audience, since one cannot, in fact, must not read them. Positioned between Soviet samizdat culture and the international art market, the little coffins stand at the intersection of multiple systems and so offer the possibility of an afterlife such as that proposed by the responses of these US poets. In their very undead form and parasitic relation to their deceased verse, the little coffins evoke Benjamin's concept of afterlife or nakhleben. Conforming to this concept, the post-Soviet afterlife of the little coffins interrupts the given by stressing the continuous reworking of historical understanding at a moment of historical, social and geopolitical change. The little coffins come to be read as addressing globalisation, reframing their earlier examination of the fetishised Samizdat text as a figure for the fragility of human life, and the obsession with the poet or artist's every word, and the figurative and literal death of the poet within the Russian literary tradition. The buried Samizdat poem outlives the Samizdat text in the post-Soviet era by becoming a kind of calling card for Pregev's position at the juncture of late Soviet dissident culture, Soviet ideology, post-Soviet Russian nationalism, and the global art market. When I interviewed Plegov in Moscow in 2006, just a year before his own death, he insisted that poetry itself was passé, that he produced not poems, but contemporary art, shifting to English to express the term contemporary art. In a late piece, the video opera Rossiya, play you a little bit of. In this late piece, the video opera Rossiya, or Russia, from 2004, Plegov returns to his relation to Western conceptualism to emphasise this renunciation of poetry, never, of course, actually realised, again marking the encounter between national traditions and global art. Accompanied by a soundtrack of slow-tempo romantic piano music with kind of Russian folk inflections, the short film comprises Plegov's attempt to make a cat say the word Rossiya, or Russia. Too comic effect. Give you a little taste. Attempts there. So the film concludes when Plegov is joined by his son, his actual son, and the two then sing Rossiya together. The cat never manages. The piece alludes to piece Interview with a Cat from 1970 by Marcel Brothers, who, like Plegov with his Little Coffins, had staged his transformation from a poet to a visual artist by turning his books into sculptural works that rendered them unreadable. Where Brothers talks to his cat about conceptualist art, however, Plegov combines Western conceptualist practice with repetitive nationalist ideology. Plegov's return to the subject of his relation to Russian nationalism and Western conceptualist art coincides with the revival of conceptualism, not as an artistic, but as a literary practice in an Anglo-American context. Led by writers such as Kenneth Goldsmith, like Plegov, a sculptor-turned-poet, and hailed by influential critics such as Marjorie Perloff as the new 21st-century poetics, conceptual writing became the most influential English-language avant-garde poetry of the first decade of the new millennium. Yet for all that Goldsmith and Perloff insist that conceptual poetry adopts a principled, unoriginal or uncreative approach, neither cites Plegov's precedent. Perloff's omission of Plegov perhaps reflects her assertion in the early 1990s that his conceptualism depended on the romantic concept of psychological depth, and so was almost the antithesis of the conceptualism of our, that is, American, Anglo-American, 60s and 70s, which rejected the notion of hidden meaning outright. Her distinction in turn derived from Greuze's Cold War-inflected opposition, which was mapped out over two decades before the rise of Anglo-American conceptual writing. When, in his introduction to the 2011 anthology of conceptual writing Against Expression, Craig Dworkin mentions Plegov's example, it comes as no surprise, therefore, that he does so only to warn that it should not be confused with conceptual writing. This is despite the fact that Dworkin, like Greuze, some 34 years earlier, cites Menard's act of copying word for word and line for line as exemplary of as an exemplary forerunner of conceptual practice. The binary opposition between Russian and Western conceptualism continues to resonate today, therefore, despite its being playfully parodied in many of Plegov's works. Notwithstanding Perloff's claim that conceptual writing reflects a new indeterminacy of location in the age of the internet, the opposition demonstrates the persistence of national difference and Cold War-derived East-West binaries in the discourse of globalisation. Rejecting these binaries, Plegov presents a complex cross-hatching of various traditions and discursive systems each with local associations and global ambitions. He highlights, as he puts it, the absurdity of the total ambitions inherent in the desire to capture and describe the entire world. He estranges any one national position or global vision, generating many lines of languages, media, economy, economies, ideologies, and histories whose singular points of intersection are ultimately undefined. Like Baidel and Plegov, Charles Bernstein emphasises the place of rhetoric and thinking comparatively and cross-culturally, and in addressing the relation of literature and culture to globalisation. Addressing the changes wrought between the late Cold War era and the post-9/11 world, Bernstein's writing foregrounds the rhetorical dichotomy that continues to dominate comparative thought, the binary between commonness and strangeness that shapes the way we understand both our recent past and our current era. On the one hand, his texts address the dichotomy between aesthetic and ideological readings of contemporary literature and culture. On the other, they tackle the related problem of the loss of affect and the distant reading practices that a global perspective can seem to entail. Unlike the other writers I've discussed, Bernstein does not seek alternatives to these binaries, but plays with and exacerbates them, insisting on their inescapability for a writer based in New York at the heart of the world's cultural, geopolitical, and economic system. Even so, Bernstein does offer a response to these entrapping dichotomies. His writing invites a mode of reading that operates between these two approaches, or what he terms frames, deploying each to unsettle the other, to reveal its blind spots and assumptions. This frame switching in turn produces moments of resonant dissonance, an out-of-sync dance, in his terms, between the global distance of a superpower and the affective immediacy of a song of resistance. The events of September 11, 2001 and the bellicose response of the United States raised the stakes in the competition between global distance and affective immediacy, and between ideological and aesthetic readings. In the United States, politicians appealed to the awful horror of the destruction of the Twin Towers in reviving the them and us rhetoric of the Cold War and giving free rein to the security services' suspicious readings for signs of the enemy. In his 2006 collection, Girly Man, Bernstein responded with a widely noted shift to a seemingly more direct and accessible style. Many of the poems in Girly Man seem to reach for the affective immediacy resisted in his earlier writing. The surface belies, however, a more distanced poetic, an affective dead zone that functions as a biting counterpoint to the poem's apparent accessible and personal style. Girly Man addresses the problem of affect perhaps most obviously through the inclusion of pieces written in the immediate post-9/11 period, in which Bernstein's persona mask seemed, at least for some, to slip to produce the formulas that Bernstein has elsewhere attacked in his writing on writing, as Susan Schultz put it. In the context of Girly Man, however, what seems at stake in all these poems is the use of these formulas for transparency, directness, and simplicity. Bernstein highlights these formulas in the Let's Just Say sequence, alluding to William Carlos Williams' rhetoric of directness in This Is Just a Say, and including what he claims to be a totally accessible poem, his words, that is all about communication, heart to heart. Which is quite funny if you know Bernstein's work. In the third section in Girly Man, entitled World on Fire, Bernstein moves from the ground zero of anti-affect in the opening section to a more complex engagement with lyric enunciation. World on Fire immediately follows the September 11 cycle, Some of These Days, in Girly Man, and was first published as a chapbook in 2004 when it was clearly located in the context of the US invasion of Iraq. The title of the cycle refers to the popular song I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire, which, in the version recorded by the Ink Spots, became a hit after the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941. Most of the poems from World on Fire draw on popular songs of the 1930s and 1940s. The one exception is Broken English, the title of a well-known song by Marian Faithfull. And I'll read you Bernstein's poem, this title on page 4 of the handout. Broken English. What are you fighting for? The men move decisively toward the execution chamber. Joey takes aim but muffles his fire. Overhead, the crescent moon cracks the unbroken sky. A moth beats its wings against the closed door, intransigence its only law. What are you fighting for? The sirens cry wolf to the obedient masses who sway, hysterical in sync to the boys on the back streets and the ladies of mourning. Brushing up fate pixel by pixel, burnishing dusk, the sum of entropy and elevation. Tony takes it in his intestine, the sharp pain in his body like ripples in a sand dune, his face exquisitely detached from any sign of the sensation. What are you fighting for? The market plunges, savings slip away like a greased pig in a taffy pull. Sometimes the easiest thing is just to stop thinking about it, then it can just think you. Depending on the angle of incline and the rate of decomposition, wives to each other, husbanding the fear that feeds upon itself and its prey. Doesn't that count for something, even in these pitched accommodations? What are you fighting for? What are you fighting for? The title, Broken English, immediately introduces the problems of comparison posed and explored by Bernstein in many of his writings, especially in his essays on Ezra Pound and on the poetics of the Americas, as he terms it. Broken English refers not only to Faithfull's 1979 song, but also to the dialects and non-standard Englishes that he elsewhere suggests furnish a pluralist model for commonality and comparison. As part of World on Fire, Broken English claims a place within this global space of comparison and difference, or what he calls commonality and partiality. Just as this pluralist model represents for Bernstein the political reversal of Poundian centrism, so the appeal to English here acknowledges how imperialism and racial theory inadvertently produced a plural hybrid notion of English and Englishness. Relatedly, Broken English suggests a tension or fight between aesthetic and ideological readings. What are you fighting for also poses the question, what are you reading for? You might read the poem as an isolated literary object, protected from the world of the war, the rhyme word for fighting for, and faithful song, but a word that the poem is unable or unwilling to enunciate. The poem also invites, however, an ideological or hermeneutically suspicious reading that asks what the poem itself is fighting for. Does it expose or merely reinforce the workings of power on a global scale, from Auschwitz, gas chambers, the execution chamber, to desert warfare in Iraq, like ripples in a sand dune? The question echoes Bernstein's insistence in his essay Pounding Fascism, that it is always revealing of a work, revealing to ask of a work, what does it serve and how? For instance, the word war maintains an overwhelmingly ghostly presence in the poem through its absence. Its absence invites a symptomatic reading of the poem as an expression of schizophrenic postmodernist subjectivity, unable to articulate a direct political critique, as in Jameson's reading of Perlman's China, to return us to the beginning. Yet neither the aesthetic nor the ideological reading defines the poem and the fight over interpretation that it provokes. Rather, the poem and fight are about the problem of reading itself. Like Derek Jarman's music video, Broken English, produced to accompany the release of Faithful's song, Bernstein's poem deploys a collage poetics of geographical and historical sweep from sand dune to taffy pull that invites a consideration of how the reader should traverse discontinuities in language and in the world. The poem implies that both pitched battles and accommodations are problematic, and so suggests the inadequacy of readings that, on the one hand, seek to accommodate the poem's diverse materials into a single ideological message, and, on the other hand, insist on the text's irreducible resistance. The poem negotiates the loss of affect in the face of the global scale of comparison by thematising the absence or failure of sensation. Men move decisively toward the execution chamber, his face exquisitely detached from any sign of the sensation. The lack of feeling here echoes Faithfull's song, Cold, Lonely Puritan. Like Faithfull's song, Bernstein's poem uses detached language to describe a violent act, apparently undertaken without emotion, without feeling, without hesitation, decisively. The poem describes murder, broken bodies, and language is itself broken, disconnected from its affective content. Bernstein's text abounds in clichés such as takes aim, sharp pain in his body, and the market plunges, performing the disconnection between feeling and expression that it describes. But like Faithful's song, Bernstein's poem produces affect out of this failure, out of the totalising figure of broken English and its borrowed refrain. Ironically, the poem's emotional impact emerges from the discrepancies between sensation and expression. These discrepancies parallel the apparent lack of emotional response from the addressee in Faithful's song. She carries on after losing her father, husband, mother and children. In both Faithful's punk-inflected song and Bernstein's broken English, the absence of emotional response is what moves the reader, an effect that relies on this oscillation between affective engagement and generalising the attached distance between commonness and strangeness. On the 20th of March 2003, the New Zealand state broadcaster, Radio New Zealand, interrupted its regular schedule to announce that US-led forces had entered Iraq. Obviously prepared for the inevitable news, the announcer immediately switched to Marianne Faithful's broken English. Like Bernstein, the radio station repeated this old song to protest an event that was itself a reprise of a war that 12 years earlier had helped mark the end of the Cold War. Faithful's song likewise repeated and transformed a refrain of a 1960s anti-war song, Country Joe and the Fishers, I Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die rag. With its refrain, what are you fighting for? In the cracked voice introduced by Faithful's comeback album, Broken English tracked a collective and personal narrative from 1960s utopianism to 1970s militant radicalisation of faithlessness. Faithful dedicated the song that served as an anti-war anthem a quarter of a century later to the anti-nuclear campaigner turned militant or terrorist Ulrike Meinhof. Equally prophetically, she anticipated the replacement of the Cold War with its rhyming partner, an old war. It is tempting to take such recurrences or historical rhymes between the Cold War world and today as evidence that history comprises progressive developments on a theme, new battles in the same old war. Reproductions of sameness and difference across time and space, languages and cultures. And so it seems appropriate to end by turning to the opening lines of a poem by the US poet Lynn Hagenian. This is the last quotation in your handouts. Humans repeat themselves, and such habitual ways of thinking and writing can take captives, as Hagenian suggests in this poem, The Guard. This poem, The Guard, was Hagenian's first attempt to use her experience of Russia, what I have elsewhere called her Russian estrangement, to cross the divisions of the Cold War, published in 1984. Read alongside the poem's later... The Guard's later reference to a picture, the opening lines echo the words of Wittgenstein. A picture held us captive and we couldn't get outside it, for it lay in our language and language seemed only to repeat it to us inexorably. We cannot escape these repetitions in language, the tracing over and over again of what seems to be nature, but which is in fact merely the frame through which we look at it. Yet by crossing languages, by highlighting the contingency of any single frame, any one linguistic, geographical, historical or cultural position, we can come to recognise such recurrences, including the commonness strangeness binary, as something other than an unmediated picture of reality, and so begin to read and write the world differently.
Thank you, Jacob. A quick question. Abandoned my position to ask you. Actually, two really quick questions. First was in the Baihua mountain poem. Just wondering, in Chinese, is there room for a kind of a pun on Bai, because Bai in a different tone also, but in a similar character means white.
Yeah, sure.
So plain, yeah. So that is also being played at, that it's not only 100 flowers, but it's also a white flower, which is a snow-covered flower.
Yeah, that's possible. Yeah, I hadn't really considered that, but yeah, definitely a possible reading. Yeah.
The other question,
and also would be interesting to consider in terms of his later reference to Marx, his use of this passage of Marx on censorship, where he's arguing against censorship, and obviously in 1978. Baidel uses this in the editorial for the first issue of Jintian or Today, which is the first unofficial literary magazine published in the People's Republic of China. And it's kind of used, you know, partly to, you know, get some protection, political protection. Citing Marx is always a good way to do that. But yeah, there Marx is saying, you know, there are no black flowers, so the white flower, you know, is exactly diametrically opposite to it, and perhaps feeds into this too. Yeah.
The other kind of more of a question than anything else, the Mores work on Sky and Sea. I was trying to think about who the audience is for this in a way that because one of the, of course, if you don't read or write Russian, then the word mope appears all over this work, which, and I'm just wondering if that's sort of an accidental, I don't know if there's a word for that. By introducing a kind of completely, you know, because of the Cyrillic alphabet, just a sort of an accident of the Cyrillic alphabet that what in Russian is, I have no idea, but I mean, sounds rather romantic, and Moria sounds like it should be a C, whereas Mope is about as
unromantic and deflating as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah. It is, if you mix the words or letters around, it is poem.
Yeah.
But I was just wondering if Krigov would have picked up on that or thought
well, he may
that.
Have had, you see, I mean, Krigov's English is pretty good, but his wife is a translator of English, and was a professional translator at this point, so he had very good access to English language material and also kind of knowledge of English, especially through her. That's quite possible, and I think, you know, kind of goes to what is quite a characteristic move of Krigov to kind of play games between, you know, this is point of, you know, kind of intersecting lines of different kind of cultural and linguistic material, you know, to produce new resonances. Yeah. Yeah. Good, nice set of points. Thank you.
I'm sorry you didn't read the Russian poem.
Sorry. Yeah, it was just time.
Looking at the English.
Yep.
But by the way, you can just explain what's going on, because we have policemen, not spelt the same way as policemen.
Yep.
And this seems to match some juggling with the words at the ends of the lines of the Russian.
Yep.
So what is that saying?
Okay, so.
And would it say it in another language? Because you did claim that this poetry was trying to not get lost in translation.
I didn't say that. I was talking about Owen's argument that, you know, that there was a kind of poetry written to be translated. I wouldn't be saying exactly that. I'm saying that it's Krigov's work is always kind of playing with kind of Russian cultural traditions, ideologies, but also kind of not allowing that to separate from kind of claims to kind of wider world, and kind of mixing those things up, producing intersecting lines as between Russian and English, between poem and mope and sea and whatever. But to come back to the word policeman, what we have here is Litsanier, which is as you can see further down. There's also Militsioner, which is actually the correct spelling in Russian, but of course people, you know, as an English slur their speech. And particularly the misspelling is associated with a kind of more popular, kind of low style, and is part of the way in which Krigov creates the character of the Militsioner, and he tends to be called, you know, with this misspelling, Militsioner, rather than Militsioner. The idea being that he's kind of creating this sort of somewhat kind of folksy character who wants to be a kind of great Russian poet, but there's also a kind of bathetic quality to this sort of the failure of the style, as you know, obviously, you know, this sort of representing the Soviet policeman as the sort of hero of Russian literature is humorous in itself, but it's kind of gets played up by this failure to kind of match the literary language.
Yes, but these are ideas that you might have about the poem, or draw from the poem.
Yep.
I want to know if they translate into the English.
Okay, you see your question. Well, I mean, does policeman, it's an attempt by the translator, this is actually Jerry Yanacek's translation, I should acknowledge it here, to get at something similar. It is important that there's a spelling distinction, Whether it has the same cultural resonance in English, I think, is impossible, particularly now that, you know, you can say to many Russians, militsioner, it's kind of a known kind of character within Russian culture. So, of course, policeman is not going to have any of that kind of resonance to it.
There's a kind of cockney, yeah. So that's
reasonably okay in the sense that it's a sort of, you know, kind of working class accent thing. So that sort of ties in somewhat with this, but yeah. It's never quite the same, is it? I mean, when you translate, you're always moving cultural situations. You're going to have a different set of connotations with a word. Yeah.
Exactly. Indeed, it does seem to be so. But I thought that for the kind of poetry that you're telling us about might have a new way to do better in that exact way. Is it because of the ideas that are sort of around it or drawn from it, rather than because the words are transmitting better across culture?
I guess one of my key points is that, you know, globalisation gets bandied around a lot, and yet there is no such thing as a pure kind of globalisation, right? What we have is local engagements, which are always also not just local engagements. This is the problem with the local global binary, that are also engaging, you know, internationally, transnationally, in various ways. And so this is a work which is very much within kind of now within Russian national consciousness. And very much in that Soviet period, was in there. And yet, part of what was characterised, this is one of the most famous policeman poems, was its kind of appeals. You see, you know, to kind of claiming the whole world, which is a sort of element of, you know, Soviet ideology. You know, we're the kind of centre of the world. Moscow is the third Rome, and so forth too. But it also relates to Prigov's, you know, refusal to. You know, his wanting to kind of engage with Western conceptualism and play with it and, you know, kind of compete with it too. So that those local engagements are never separate from international engagements, I guess is the point of what I'm saying. Does that make sense? Not that we ever get to texts that are fungible in the way that Stephen Owen wants to claim. I just think I don't believe that.
You're looking at me as if you'd like me to say something more, but it's hogging the time.
Okay. But anyway, I hope that answers your question. Yeah.
I think each time I make two remarks in this before the minute.
I'm going to get in trouble.
I've been given permission here, which I think is a very unwise thing. He remarks at one point my words and therefore my meaning. Stop anywhere short of the fact, which seems to be something that we're kind of alluding to some extent in the Chinese poem with which you began. But then when you made these remarks about translatability and globalization and whether it was possible, I was reminded of something else that you remarked. We tend to say, you ask, dog does not speak. Is that because a dog doesn't think? Well, a dog doesn't speak. That's what you can say. Right. And I mean, then it's pretty well done.
I think so. So
that it's in the words.
Yeah, that's right. That yeah.
Trying to see something propositional.
Yeah.
Ideation.
Yeah.
To some extent, which is the real meaning of the word.
That's right, that's right. If you see this idea of a kind of image that can be translated outside the words, it's not actually, what's how language works.
And nevertheless, they're in tension.
Yeah.
There's a sense in which the words have to not stop anywhere short of the fact in order to mean anything at all.
Yeah.
There's another sense in which the words themselves are what we've got to deal with.
Yeah. So, it's very much in that kind of tension, and with that tension, I see these poets as working. Really,
I think that I don't know. One tends as a debate in cognitive philosophy to be very reductive about these things. A tendency which always has to be resisted.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, it's part of this problematic. I mean, I went to Wittgenstein particularly in the context of thinking about repetition too, and the way in which that frames out our thought at the end here. Yeah, yeah. But also this kind of the kind of conceptual way in which we look for those rhymes and those repetitions. And so one of the problems, I think, with one of the arguments of the book is that what happened at the end of the Cold War was that people, you know, theorists, writers struggled to kind of catch up with what was, you know, would have been really dramatic changes geopolitically, culturally, and economically the last couple of decades. And in a sense, what we ended up with often were kind of reproductions of Cold War binary oppositions, reframed particularly through this local global opposition, but not really kind of interrogating, well, what had changed, and you know, were these the sort of right ways to think about things anyway? So, yeah.
Until now, religion had
that
because right? You say you have done wonderful analysis about that also learned from other two authors. My question here is that when I read Beta, one of the things that strikes me is that it's kind of radical break from the tradition Chinese literature, Chinese poetry. So I cannot really say, for example, from this one, I cannot really say any kind of connotations or kind of elements from the traditional Chinese poetry tradition. Is this also a feature with other two authors? You know?
Well, and I see that.
So what? Yeah. What kind of yeah. this would oh, indicate?
That's a good question, a really good question, and obviously there are multiple traditions that become available. It's part of the kind of contemporary literary context too. There is the classical Chinese tradition, obviously. There's also a modern tradition of modern Chinese poetry, and then there's a kind of world literature tradition, which generally meant Western literary texts in Chinese translation. Beidou was most aware of was these texts of so-called world literature, which were Western modernist texts, like Baudelaire, translated into Chinese by Chinese modernist poets, many of whom couldn't publish their work in the People's Republic of China in the 1950s, and it was very difficult to get hold of the pre-1949 works, but out, you know, as in the Soviet Union for a time, translation became an outlet for that practice. So there is, I think, a relationship that's at least one of the kind of acknowledged sources for Beidou's approach. And you can see this kind of in the kind of Western style form and rhyme scheme of this poem, which is, you know, it's very, really would strike us as quite conventional from a Western perspective, and that's sort of what Stephen Arnold was getting at. But Beidou was also very dismissive of Chinese tradition, or really wanted to get away from it. In that sense, he also shares something with, you know, or with the kind of Cultural Revolution moment, in a sense, you know, that kind of smashing of tradition. You know, famously, he was taken to Oxford in the 80s and said, oh, you do want to come and see, you know, because Oxford has this amazing collection of ancient Chinese manuscripts and so forth. Do you want to come and see some of our, you know, printed books? And it's like, no, I'm not interested in any of that stuff, you know. And one of the things he really hated was anyone trying to produce his poems in calligraphy, because it smacked of that tradition. But Plekhov, on the other hand, is kind of, well, he's sort of interested in mucking around the tradition too, but by kind of endlessly returning to it. So Eugene Onegin becomes the master text of Plekhov's work. I think I played to some of you last year. Grieg does, one of his performance pieces was performing the opening lines of Eugene Onegin in different styles, you know, kind of liturgical style, and kind of throat singing style, and so forth. So, Charles Bernstein, the tradition that is interesting for him is a kind of modernist American tradition, I think, that he's really defining himself in relationship to and opposition to. And particularly Pound, in the book I discuss, this is the relationship to Pound, because Pound provides, on the one hand, a kind of model for a kind of pan-cultural poetics, and yet on the other hand, Pound is the last person you want to go to for claiming this thing, given his fascist ideology, his racism, and everything else. And Charles Bernstein is a Jewish, American Jewish writer too, so that tension is very strongly felt. So yeah.
It's interesting because yeah. Pound was very much influenced by classic Chinese literature.
Yeah. So there are many different connections and circles in here. Yeah.
We're past our time, so we should probably wrap this up. But I do hope that some of you will probably join me because I'm thirsty. Crossing the road, we often go over to Eureka and have a drink. If you can do so.